You're listening to Conversations with Everyday Innovators on With Tamara Gondor Podcast. Let's take a moment to thank our generous partners that make this possible.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to another incredible episode of With Tamara Gondor, all about these everyday innovators. And I have got an incredible one for you today with what I know is going to be just buckets of insight, if that's even a phrase. I don't even know. Jake, welcome to the show. I'm so excited to have you here. Tell the world about kind of who you are and the business that you are in.
I'm excited. And I like that you set the bar at I have to provide buckets of insights too, right? So it's not like just one or two points. So yeah, I'm really excited for the conversation. I really enjoyed going through the experience ahead of time too. So I am a CEO. I'm an ex-sales leader, entrepreneur, CEO, dad. I run a sales strategy and consulting firm, which always sounds interesting. Consulting after anything sounds amazing. But really what we're doing is partnering with organizations to help to modernize the way they interact with their customers, whether that's how they generate new customers and generate leads, how they work with customers in the customer experience as from a sales process standpoint, or how they engage once somebody is a customer. And the way that customers want to engage with companies, especially in like the B2B world, B2C, it's already changed. It's like, talk to a person, yuck, right? Like, but in B2B, we are way behind. And so a lot of the work that we do with companies that are trying to modernize and provide truly a mix of a self-guided virtual white glove service with a mix of different tools and processes and people. So that's what gets me excited.
So I've done a little bit of work with customer service groups, keynoting, stuff like that, not deep the way you are. And I've been in the B2B world for a long time as well prior to all this. So I know what you mean that the business to business world versus business to consumer. So if those listening don't know what the difference is, business is to consumers, like I go and I buy a product or service like at Target or whatever, right? Like our food, our hair care, like all that. B2B is like IBM selling to a company their IT solutions. So business to business. So here's my question for you, because I totally agree with you that in the B2B world, we're a little bit behind when it comes to sales and customer experience. And I used to hear a lot of, well, it's not the human sale, right? It's like, we're not B2C, so we're not the human sale. It's a process sale. And I always kind of fought against that. But I'm just curious from your perspective, why in this world, because so many of us are in it, do we miss the changes that are happening around us?
It's interesting. And I would say it's both, right? It's human and process. And I think, well, there's a couple of reasons, some more obvious than others. One is people are entrenched to, and rightfully so, because their pay is tied to, if I'm a CRO, right, a head of sales at a company, do I want my job to appear harder or easier? Do I want to admit that people are more informed and therefore I don't need as big of a sales team, or that the job is different? It's more of like guiding people along versus having to really inform them, guide them, whereas opposed to today, they come in, they've Googled you and your two competitors. You just have to assume that that's happened. So I think part of it is behavior, that when you have people in leadership, they're disincentivized from wanting the process to be different. You know, we judge many leaders by the size of the teams they've managed versus the impact that they've been able to have. And so I think we've got a lot of what we'll call like internal factors that are part of that. And then I think two is, look, it's somewhat related. We have these roles that we've defined that haven't changed a ton. That, I talked to this like qualifying person and a salesperson. And so, and then maybe I get handed off again. And so we also just have a lot of history here that we're just not quite ready to evolve quickly. Sales just isn't used to moving quickly. They bring in a sales trainer here or there, or they, maybe change their process every 5 years, 10 years, whereas marketing it by nature almost optimizes, iterates. And I think we're bringing more and more of that to the sales, that kind of always optimizing mindset.
So it's interesting to me on a lot of levels, but one of the things that I hear you say is like, there's a fear of becoming irrelevant because how we've done things, and to your point, how we judge things is changing, but that changes us a little bit too. And how
a lot.
We work. Yeah. And the skills that we have to have. And what you said is so true. We judge people based on, like, salespeople in particular, based on, well, how many salespeople have you led? 100. Well, that's like, you must be amazing.
Man, he must be a genius.
Right. As opposed to like, hey, did you figure out a way to really serve the customers and bring new bundles to them or new services to them?
Exactly.
Yeah. I'm curious from your perspective, where does innovation play a role in this? Like, how do we, I know that sounds like a naive question, but I'd love to hear how you
think about it. No, not at all. No, not at all. I'm really excited. I mean, for me, what this is about is companies getting more in tune with their customers. And although that might seem obvious, right? Or, you know, to many people.
Yeah, we miss it. So obviously it's not.
Yeah, well, because we have kind of our process for a long time. Again, it's been, imagine in this B2B environment and candidly in B2C before 5 years ago, it's not that long ago. You know, you had to go to a store to get educated on something. You had to, like, you could find some information online 10 years ago, but still, like, you know, you'd want to go and feel it. You wanted to experience it. Well, now we can experience, compare, and do so many more of these things digitally. And as we get more and more used to that in our consumer behavior, we now expect that when we buy things as a professional from another company, where it's, you know, hey, instead of me having to hop on a call, can you just send me something? Can you send me the recorded demo? I'll look at it over the next little bit here. We can still set up a call, but can I get to step three before I want to engage a human?
Yeah.
And I think, you know, if you want to kind of think of the proxies, think about buying a home and buying a car. 10 years ago, of course you get a real estate agent. What do you mean? How else am I going to do this? Now, I think, I can't remember the stat from last year. It's like 2020 or 2019. It's like 72% of homes were found by the buyer. And then you got a real, like, and we've got to think all those behaviors, even these big ticket item behaviors are going to permeate throughout our life. Like, we're going to be used to click to buy. I talked about my experience with Salesforce, which is a customer relationship management tool. And, you know, we're a small client for them. And, you know, we're not huge, maybe like 20-30K client for them. And I was trying to renew. I'm like, why won't you just let me enter my credit card? It's just like, stop trying to sell. Like, why is there no portal? So it's some of those things that, again, for some of your listeners who may not be as familiar, it's B2B is very much like talk to somebody. You have to do this. And we're ready to innovate. And we're seeing more and more. There's over 2,000 sales technologies now that are trying to help people to self-guide, compare tools. So we're just going to see a lot more of that coming up.
But here's the thing that I found what you're saying super interesting. So, and I'm just going to share a personal story from last week. So, you know, to no surprise, we sell the assessment, which we're going to talk about in a second, right, in bundles. And so companies will buy the innovator assessment for their people in packages. And when last week I got an email in from someone who wanted a very large number of them. And so in my head, I went old school and I was like, well, let's set up a time to talk. I'd love to hear more about your objectives, right? Does that sound like super old school? Are you laughing at me, Jake?
No, it's not. It's normal. It's just normal.
So I sent that email back, right? I did it. I'm just going to own it. I did it. I went like back to my old behavior. And the person responded with, do you just have a one pager that I can forward? Now in my head, I start panicking. Oh my God, they're not going to buy. This is just, they're just shopping, blah, blah, blah. But then I had to take a step back and I thought, wait a minute, hold on, to your point, like maybe they just don't want to talk to somebody. They're busy, right? We're all time starved right now. And so I had to think differently about my one pager too, because I thought this is not an informational sheet. This is a buying sheet. So how do I think differently about it before I send it over? So I had to actually rework it completely and send it over. But Jake, I so badly wanted to be like, let's find out a time to talk.
I get it. Trust me. That's me too, right? No, I totally get it. That's me. I mean, I think the key is, look, it's not that that's not the right thing to do. It 100% is. It's, you know, right now, and maybe this is a simple way to put it. It's most companies have had a selling process, and because everyone was coming in at basically the same level of intent. Now you have people coming in with no knowledge, some knowledge, advanced knowledge, and like ready to purchase knowledge. And most sales processes are not engineered to understand that. Whereas on your digital selling experience, like on B2C, they know, hey, based on where you came from a website, I'm going to surface this landing page to you or this one. We just haven't adapted 4 different buying processes or selling processes. We still just have this kind of one. And so that's where the disconnect happens, is you try to meet everyone at this like relatively low intent level, when the reality is many people might be at 2 or 3 or 4.
No, they were at 95% intent. I almost ruined it. Let's just call it like I almost talked them out of it. Unfortunately, I didn't. I stopped myself, but I really, it was close. I think this is so insightful, Jake. And I just want to make the point to everybody of pay attention to where we are relying on old processes when the behavior of the people that we serve, and whether that's customers, clients, or even your leadership in your company, where they've evolved, but we haven't evolved with them. And I think all of us probably have some of those old patterns that we're holding on to that are actually hindering our success. So we're making it harder for ourselves in a lot of ways. And to your point, I can't tell you the number of times where I've gone into a meeting to get buy-in for an idea with leadership and they were already a yes. And I'm already arguing trying to move them to a buying place and they're already there, but I didn't start from understanding where they are. I started from understanding where I am, which is very different. So, and I just, before I can, I've got so many more questions for you, Jake, but before we go on, I just want to say, so Jake took the Everyday Innovator assessment because we wanted to know what he was before I came on. And you're an inquisitive collaborative with the dormant of experiential. And which is interesting because I'm a risk taker experiential with the dormant of collaborative. So you and I would work very well together because we have opposites. But what's interesting is the inquisitive collaborative, the power triggers, means that you bring deep and whole innovation to the table. So inquisitive is all about digging deep, asking questions, challenging assumptions. That's how you innovate. And the collaborative is all about pulling disparate people and ideas and experiences together. And I hear that in what you're talking about reassessing processes and kind of seeing it for the bigger picture that it really is. It's really cool. So we'll dig into it a little bit more, but I just wanted to set the stage for people of kind of who we're talking to here and where he's coming from. So let me flip it for a second. What are some of the biggest challenges that you faced and how have you overcome them?
My view on challenges, I think, is also maybe unique. You know, I think very early on, and it's why I naturally gravitated, really started in college, let's call it, where, you know, what job? I got a telemarketing job because it paid the most. And I was able to get punched in the face verbally by, you know, and not take it personally and I think I've always had a very unique ability to be honest, very honest with myself, but without judging myself. And so when I look at challenges, I look at them as data points. I look at success and failure in a, like, okay, hey, I do this thing, it goes really well, data point. I do this other thing, it doesn't. So I think for me, I've always had a really interesting view of challenge that it's not success, fail, it's data point. And I think, you know, going back when I was a kid, I used to love science. I used to love, like, you know, taking like IB chemistry and like the scientific method, which is like, hypotheses are not right nor wrong. They're just things that you think might happen and there are outcomes that happen. And if it doesn't happen, it's not bad or good. And so I think a lot of my life, I've always viewed challenge as a data point versus a permanent point or a reflection of me as a human being. And I think for me, you know, some of the challenges I've had to come back to, though, I think are as you continue to make the move up as a leader, just your organization, your team, your department, your organization requires more and more a different skill set. So I think the challenges I've faced and then the data points I've received that said, hey, you're sucking at this are, you know, usually around, you know, how do you really empower people and how do you make sure that people are set up for success when you feel like you're an expert at something? And I'm sure a lot of people have struggled with that, where they're like, I'll just do it myself. You know, I'll just, and I've gotten over that a long time ago, but I think I have to continue as we grow as an organization to get better at, I call it giving up your Legos and letting the other people play with the Legos. I don't need them all, you know? So, you know, but I think that that's something that I continue to work on.
Can you give me a real world example of you kind of working through that? Because I hear you and I love it. And I struggle with it. I think we all do because, right, it hurts. It's like someone called our baby ugly or, you know, this big idea we had got turned down.
Yeah. I can give it quite a few. I mean, look, I think the nature of being in sales is a constant daily reminder of failure with a few intermittent successes mixed in. And so I think for me, you know, it's like, look, if you're, you know, think back to one of my very first jobs, I had to make 100 calls a day, have 2.5 hours of talk time. It's pure, like that every day is a challenge, like every day to get to those numbers and then to have a very small amount and maybe one or two person says, yeah, I'll agree to meet with you. And then you've got to sell them. So for me, I think it was, I conditioned that way that I don't think you can be successful in marketing or sales, candidly, it's any role, but sales really just amplifies your learning curve of how many successes and failures that you're going to have on a daily basis. So for me, I think it was, you know, there definitely were times I remember early in my career where, yeah, someone would, you know, deceive me. Yeah, we're going to do this thing or something. And I'm like, how dare you? We had, I actually do remember that. I was like, we had a verbal agreement. And the guy's like, what are you talking about, kid? Like, I said, I think we're going to do it. And then I said, no. And then I think I tried to pull out like my college law, which is like tort law, that like a verbal agreement, it didn't go well. Let's put it that way. So I think I used to take it more personally of like, man, I suck, or like, that's not great. But again, I think there was just a point where I realized like, that's not going to help me. Like me sitting here talking shit on myself whenever I've got these people, I got enough people talking trash on me. I don't need to be another one. Not that I don't have my own negative self-talk for sure. Right. That I, you know, continue to try to shut up, but I really feel like it really came from just being conditioned in the day-to-day to where it's like, if I was going to be successful, I couldn't have that mindset of like, everything's a challenge, because every day was so, you know, candidly like challenging.
You're listening to Conversations with Everyday Innovators on With Tamara Gondor podcast. Let's take a moment to thank our generous partners that make this possible.
Can't wait to share this product with you. It's made a huge difference in my household. It's Howdy Puppy, the premier CBD pet treats for dogs. Now, for those of you who know me, you know I have a 100-pound Mastiff named Zoe Bear, and she is a cuddle bun, but she's 10 years old. And she suffers from two things. First, from the aches and pains of old age. We go for these long walks that she loves, but afterwards she's got joint stiffness and it's hard for her to get up off the floor. And she suffers from a little bit of anxiety. She doesn't love new people. So when you come over to my house, she tends to bark. She gets really anxious. She gets very riled up. So I started giving her CBD pet treats. And guess what? It has helped tremendously with both. Now her aches seem to be a little bit better. She doesn't have as hard of a time getting up off the floor. She recovers faster from our walks. And when people come over, she's less riled up. She's able to handle it better. CBD has been proven to help with aches of old age, joint stiffness, nightmares, anxiety, separation anxiety, stress, hyperactivity. I really encourage you to go check out the website. And here's the best part. It comes in three flavors, steak, bacon, and cheese wraps. And the steak look like steaks, and the bacon look like bacon. And yeah, the cheese wraps look like cheese wraps. So it's so much fun to give it to them. I'm giving Zoe a little bit of steak or a little bit of bacon or cheese every day. It's so great. She loves them. I love what it does for her. It's a win-win. And hey, if you're new to CBD pet treats like I was, I encourage you to go check out the website, because on there they have blogs that talk about the efficacy and the safety of it. This product is great. It is USA grown, USA processed and produced. It is non-GMO. The list goes on and on. But go to the website and check it out. And if you've got a dog that suffers from those aches and stiffness or anxiety or hyperactivity, this might be the product for you. Howdy Puppy. I will put the link in the show notes. And in full disclosure, I love it so much that I am a founding investor and partner. So good. Howdy Puppy.
I remember early on in my career in particular, I really suffered from overtrust, I guess is the way to put it. And once was with a client who was like, yeah, we're totally going to buy. This is amazing. We love what you're talking about. I just need to fill in the blank first and then I'll get back to you. But in my head, right, I walked away without verbal agreement in that deal. And then another time I remember where I presented some opportunities to leadership and they all gave me the thumbs up. And then 2 days later came to me and shut the whole thing down. And so I want to get really tactical with you for a moment because you're in the sales world. For those out there trying to drive new ideas, and whether that is in the marketplace or again, inside a company, how do you get past the false buying signals? Like, how do you vet that out? What's your advice for having real conversations that are going to drive that innovation forward versus just buying into like, they gave me a thumbs up? Because I can't tell you the number of times my face was in the mud having those buying signals as real when they were fake. And that's okay. It happens, but
it happens all the time. I can't imagine. I mean, I've probably heard that from reps in my life thousands of times, or entrepreneurs like that I talked to that have raised money and they've got a Series A. And now it's like, well, we have market validation. And it's like, they've told us that it's great. We've got six customers. Like, okay. Well, it goes interesting, you know, so from taking the survey, if you look at my power, it's inquisitive. That is like, it's a superpower I've just developed over time, because the reason that that outcome happened that you described, 9 times out of 10, you didn't ask the tough question. And I learned that in my career, that I became very good at picking up, you know, early on, it was like phone. We didn't do as much video conference, but I got very good on picking up on those verbal, like, yeah, that's boom. That's a trigger for me. As soon as I hear their pitch go up, there's something there. And then I got very good at saying, hey, you know, Jake, I hear like maybe there's a little hesitation. Like, tell me what you're thinking. Yeah. So I got very good at getting at reading the room and paying attention. I read a ton of books. I became a student of sales. And I think it's because of that inquisitive default. My parents called my mom called me Kaya, which stood for know-it-all, like when I was growing up. So like, because I asked why, you know, questions. So long story short, I think if you want to improve your close rate, and we've lost deals like high five. I remember we lost a 5-figure deal, mid to high 5-figure deal, because a person's like, Jake, we need you to help us with closing. And I said, okay, cool. So we're going to redo your discovery process. And I said, and they're like, no, we're good there. It's the late stage of the deal. I go, that's because you're not asking the tough questions early, and those issues manifest 2 months later. And the guy just refused to, we didn't get the deal.
They didn't want to hear it.
And so that's my feedback to everybody out there, that if you find yourself, and this is another kind of skill that I developed, which is a skill of reflection. I go back, I say, okay, so they said no. There was that meeting too. I didn't ask this person, like, is this a mission? I can always, I tell reps and teams and companies this all the time. I can trace back every single lost deal I've ever had to my lack of asking the right questions. Every single deal I've ever lost in my entire career is 100% my fault, because I heard what I wanted to hear, or I didn't ask the tough questions. And I think that mindset alone, and again, then the ability to detach, I'm not like I suck because of that, right? Yeah. I think is that inquisitiveness will make you much less likely to have that outcome.
So this is such great advice, Jake. And really, I have to say, lines with I'm now 49 years old. So it took me like 15 years to realize that I shouldn't rush to yes. And in fact, the less I rushed to yes, the more buy-in I got on the back end. But it took me a long time to figure that out. So for all of us everyday innovators out there, I just want you to be mindful of that. I think especially when you put your neck out there and you're trying to push something new into the market or into your company or into your team, we so badly want the yes. We so want it. But we actually, and so because of that, we miss, to your point, those tough questions, because we don't want to actually face them in the front end, but it actually helps us on the back end. I think that's, thank you for that. That was really great advice. I want to talk about the other side of the coin. Now we talked about challenges, or what are some of your biggest wins or things that you're most proud of in your career?
You know, it's, I think, you know, when people ask me that question, I think I'm like a lot of people, or it's like, I don't want to talk about, like, it's like, again, because I kind of don't, I try to keep the blinders on. Sometimes I don't do that. I gotta be candid. I mean, I think 2021, I mean, we had a great year, you know, like I've built a company now, we've got 45 plus people globally, and we're a people business. I bootstrapped this thing from the very beginning. So, if, you know, what I look at now is what we've been able to build and the impact we've been able to have on thousands of companies, you know, to me is probably at this point, you know, my life's biggest win. So that's great. I've closed a lot of big deals, multi-million dollar deals. Those are also great as well too. But I think, you know, the journey and the evolution to really become, you know, you talk about innovators and entrepreneurs, to really becoming a CEO or a president, you know, at that level, and the skills that it takes to get there have taken me a long time to learn and to unlearn other behaviors that made me really successful before, but held me back in, you know, really taking the company to where it could go. So
what is a skill that you think, you know, got you there, but didn't get you here?
Yeah. I mean, look, as a sales leader, usually you don't own the whole P&L. So what are you focused on? Right. So I've ran big teams of sales development, sales and customer success and operations, bottom line. And so I used to solve every problem with like, well, we can just spend more money, just sell more stuff. So I didn't have like the yin and the yang to be able to kind of balance a lot of my decision making as a CEO, I think, because I didn't really have to think about that. You know, I worked in very sales-driven organizations where we could influence product. Also, another nature of consulting that's dangerous is we can do whatever you want. Like, it's a service. And so you kind of can tend to early on, I think, you know, if it was sales or marketing related, we're like, that's our core business. And so like saying yes to things that weren't the right fit, and then being too focused on the top line with to the detriment of the bottom line, and that talking about profit and making profit is okay. I think I also had a narrative that I told myself that maybe it's a guilt narrative that if I'm taking more money out of the company, I'm not investing in it. And that was a bad narrative to have, because there's nothing wrong with making money as an entrepreneur and building a business. And I think I struggled with that guilt. It's like a weird kind of guilt of like, you know, like I could have, you know, okay, I took out 70,000. I could have hired two really junior people or one, you know, junior mid-level person with that. And always justifying that I would make the hire because then it would make more money later. You know, I think I got in that wheel for a long time.
Isn't it funny too? Because why do we become entrepreneurs? For freedom. And I also think it's what you said earlier about giving away Legos. And yeah, I love that analogy because I have two teenage boys who still love more than anything to build Legos, which makes me so happy. We have every Star Wars Lego set.
I love it.
Around this house. And I love it. I absolutely love it. But what I find is hard as you shift your role, regardless of what your role is what you said, which is, all right, well, because I can do everything and I know how to do everything, I do everything, as opposed to saying, I'm going to give some Legos away. And what I've come to find is that when I give those Legos away, they actually build things that I wouldn't have thought to build that are actually better. But it takes some humility, I think, and some willingness to release control. Have you found that?
Absolutely. Yeah, I can relate. Yes, quite a bit to that. Yeah. And I think it's also even, you know, on the outcomes, maybe it's 80, like I, you know, what I tell all entrepreneurs too, is they're scaling their sales orgs. I say, look, they're only going to be 80% as good as you were. Like you have a certain, you know, thing, whatever. And like, it's okay that you hire people that yes, you can do it better. But you have a choice to make. Like they maybe will get, and sometimes they do it 110 or 20% better. But other times it's like they're going to do it 80% or 90%. And then over time, just accept it. Right. Now, I'm not saying accept mediocrity. That's not what I'm saying. But you can't hold that one. They don't own a part of the company. You do. Yeah. So you can't hold everyone to this bar that you hold yourself to. It's not fair unless they've got a big equity stake or something in your company. So, you know, yes, the answer is I still look to get better and better at that every day.
Yes. I'm just thinking about all the Legos on my desk I should probably get rid of right now.
Good.
What is one innovative thing you've done that's helped lead to that success that you've experienced?
I saw technology come into sales, I think relatively early, meaning, you know, when I was the vice president of sales at Glassdoor, and there was a set of tools coming out in this new category called marketing automation, which allowed you to basically set up a sequence of emails that all of you love to get from companies today, right? So those are set up and you're segmented into different lists, et cetera. And there's a company called Marketo that, you know, was still kind of new-ish. This is late 2000s. I think it's 2010 maybe. And I immediately saw the application for sales of like, wait, so my sales team is going to be making calls and sending out emails. If we know the right buyer persona, can't we just adapt that to
this world
sales, not just, and so I implemented as a VP of sales in 2010, and then the next company in 2012. And then a whole category emerged, which allowed sales reps to create these sequences of activities and do calls and emails and connect with people on LinkedIn. And we were one of the very first early adopters of that technology. So I think I've always looked, you know, what is it? Like, I think I'm a relatively lazy, intelligent person, meaning I look for the easiest way to do the absolute optimal outcome. Yeah. And it doesn't mean I don't bust my ass and work really hard. I do. Right. But I also look for ways to make my time worth 150% of somebody else's time. And so I think I naturally have that mind where I'm always looking for new technology, new ways to make things easier. And so I think sales technology, and I think the work that we're doing there and the partnerships that we have now around with some of the industry leaders that we were able to pick very early I think is something that we did really well.
So here's the part that I find so insightful and relevant about that what you just shared. And that is that sometimes the best innovation is actually adapting what already exists. And I think we get stuck in this loop of I've got to be breakthrough and different and it's got to be skies and out of the box and blah, blah, blah. And what you just said is brilliant because you saw what was happening over here that was working and thought, wait a minute, there's an opportunity over here. And I think we often miss those because we're too busy with our blinders on trying to and trying to find this blue sky that nobody could have ever possibly thought of. And I don't know if you've kind of continued to do that, but I think there's
my life story.
So much value in that.
That's my life story. My life story, I'm really glad that you brought that up. All I do is take other people's best practices all day long. I'm always looking for the next thing. I'm always looking. I want you to think, there are like how many billions of people on this world? Do you know how many really original ideas there are? Like nobody has ever thought of, there's not very many, okay? There's like 0.0001% probably. So my point is I realized very on, and this is a really key, right out of college, I used to read a lot when I was a kid, got away from it in college and kind of started getting back into it. And like, I would be on the sales floor and I'd hear somebody say that. I'm like, and then it was working. I'm like, I'm just going to say that. Like, and I just would steal everyone's best practices. Like, why are you starting at step zero? It's like, we have new college grads and interns. The number one college course that is not taught today is how to Google and YouTube things, right? As opposed to like, I've never done a project that's like this before. Guess what? 1,000 people on YouTube have Google YouTube. Like go to YouTube. Like why are you trying to innovate? Like there's already a best practice. Then once you execute someone else's, then you say, oh, well, what if this? And that is how I got very good early in my career, as I kept borrowing everyone's best practice. I didn't keep trying to reinvent the wheel. I instead said, hey, there's a baseline here. And then I establish a new baseline and I try to do new things. And so for many people out there, you know, sure, innovate, but there's a lot of that innovate doesn't mean you have to start at step zero. Like on a concept, you could probably start at step 4 or 5 and save yourselves. You know, it's why people bring us in as a consulting firm. Why? Because we've been there and done it. We can help you to get ahead of the curve by 9 or 12 or 18 months because we've already done it before and you don't have to stumble over your own 2 feet. So I think it's just an important point. And I've always had that mindset, you know, from a very young age.
I think there's so much innovation in adapting what already exists. And I look for things that make me go, oh, like that's cool, right? Exactly. Anytime I see that, I'm like, oh, how do I apply that to my world? And it's interesting. I find that one of, when we work with clients, one of people's favorite team's favorite exercises to do, it's the simplest thing ever, is like, okay, let's say Peloton took over your sales consulting firm. How would they run the business? Let's say at like whoever you pick, people pick brands that they love and think are innovative. And I've seen everything from Bombas socks to Peloton to Southwest Airlines, like fill in the blank. And I love it because people light up when they talk about things they already think are innovative and cool. It opens up their sense of discovery, but then also the innovation's right there. They've already done it. Peloton's already done it. So just learn from them and apply it to your world. I love what you're saying. I think we don't define that as innovation, so we miss it, but it's the best type of innovation out there in so many ways.
Most of innovation is actually that. If you look at who actually the market leaders are, they were not the first to market. They weren't. Google wasn't the first search engine, right? Like Microsoft wasn't the first piece of software. Like Amazon wasn't the first place you could buy books online or any, like almost all of these companies that you now, Apple wasn't the first smartphone maker, right? Yeah. Like they didn't create a new category. They're a fast fall. They saw a different path. They said, hey, this is interesting. And they saw a different path. And so I think, hopefully this is a good lesson for all your listeners.
Yeah, no, I love what you were just talking about. We could have a whole thing just on how you borrow and like innovate. But we are almost out of time. I can't even believe it. As an inquisitive collaborative everyday innovator, what advice do you have to others out there that are looking to do what you've done to really drive innovation and to influence others and make that impact?
Yeah. I mean, one, because I pulled it up too. So I have it literally just like sitting right in front of me because I've been like kind of like referencing it. I'm like, oh, so that's why I act like that. I told someone the other day, the inquisitive part about it. There's a company, actually, last week I was having breakfast with a company and they were talking about their go-to-market. They'd raised a lot of money. And I was just like, I don't think that's right. And I'm like, And what I realized is, as part of the inquisitive, like, I've told people, look, I'm not the friend that you come to with half-baked ideas. I'm just going to keep asking questions, like, and it's probably not going to lead. And like, and now I know this about myself, so it's fine. So I think the key thing that I think people can learn from an inquisitive collaborative is to be truly an inquisitive. And again, I'm trying to process this myself too, as I'm having some epiphanies here too, which I like. It's my ability to stay focused on the conversation that we're having right now, to then know the right questions to continue. We're so distracted in this world today. We've got our phones within right here. We've got, you know, half of you probably have email up right now. You're multitasking while you're listening. What I think to really be a good inquisitive, you know, you've got to be able to literally put those blinders on and be present with somebody to hear what they're saying, but the words that they're saying, the way that they're saying it, et cetera. So that would be my point, is that if you're always distracted, I don't think you could ever truly be an inquisitive. If you're one of those people, I'm a multitasker, and you think that that's a good thing, right? And you don't realize that you're probably missing out on so much valuable, either spoken or unspoken information. So that would be the inquisitive side of it. The collaborative side, always ask yourself the question, has somebody else been there and done it? You know, or somebody else can help. So has somebody else already been there and done it? Some kind of what we've talked about. Like, you know, I think about the collaborative and, you know, reading the definitions, right? Tapping into the disparate people and ideas, creating intersections of random opportunity. It's like, so I'll just go YouTube 7 things and then be like, okay, based on that, here's what it is. Or I'll go ask 4 people what, hey, you've done this 17 times. So I think like that goes, I think that that's how those two play for me, is like, anytime I sit there at my, if I'm sitting at my desk or I'm talking, I'm like, I've never done this before, or I'm not sure how to go forward, I just go to Google. And I just go, or I go talk to people that I know have been there and done it. So I think those would probably be the two big things, is, you know, be present so you can be a better inquisitive. And from a, don't ever, if you're telling yourself at some point, well, I don't really know what the answer is, the really cool part is probably it's already been solved. So go reach out to people on LinkedIn or some other platform, go look at Google and YouTube, and you'll probably find, you know, a lot of ways that you can, and different vantage points that you can then triangulate and make your own.
So two amazing pieces of advice is out there for all of us. One is be present. I could not agree more that we miss so much because we're just not fully there so much of the time. That's number one. And number two is kind of what you're saying, is go wide, like look elsewhere. And it is amazing to me what you can type into the Internet of Things and find someone who's at least tried it somewhere. In fact, 1,000 people who have tried it. Like, it kind of blows my mind when I look up stuff. I'm like, oh, somebody's done this already. Like, mm-hmm. It's a little bit mind blowing when you think about it.
And I tell it, so my son's in first grade, and I'll leave, like, I really believe he should be learning this in elementary school.
Yeah.
Like, the future of our world will not be the smartest people. It will be the people who know how to access information. And not that you don't need to be smart and you don't need to study math and these things, but the ability to access the right answer versus have the right answer is the future.
I'm with you. I think it's that and critical thinking. And I think having the knowledge is irrelevant now. Like Alexa, she's probably gonna say something, though. She's right over there. Mm-hmm. And if I don't know something, I'm just all, hey, Alexa, right?
Right.
There it is. Like, it's kind of amazing. So I'm with you. And what a great lesson for all of us too, about really sharpening our research skills, for lack of a better way to say it, and our critical thinking skills, and not worrying about being right all the time, because it doesn't really matter anymore. So I think that's great. I got 2 questions for you before we have to close up.
Yeah.
One is, when you think about the lessons that you've learned being in sales for so long, and, you know, being a VP of Glassdoor and, you know, the company that you have now, what are some of those big takeaways that you've had over the years? And part of the reason, I should have said this in the beginning, but part of the reason I want to talk to you is I think Glassdoor really changed the game for employers, because suddenly there was so much transparency that we didn't have before. And I'm not in that world of looking for a job because I have a company instead, but like everybody I know was going on it. And I was like, well, there's no hiding now. So like, there's no surprises there. But when you think about the totality of your career, kind of what's a big lesson that rises to the top?
I'll keep it in that theme. I think it's transparency, meaning that for me, everything I do, if you always act like I need to be on the top of my game, I need to do this. And I think the other, and maybe to take that a step further, the less masks that you wear in your life, the better that you can be as a whole human. And that is going to make you exponentially more successful as being a husband, wife, partner, friend, and, you know, innovator, entrepreneur. And I think the more that if you realize, man, the way that I act outside of these four walls is relatively different to the way that I am here. You know, I say, do you go into work and put on your leadership cap, you know, or do you go in and put on your manager hat? That is the thing that I think has, again, it's gotten me in trouble too, right? Told bosses to F off and gotten fired. Like, I think there's a double-edged sword when you bring all these things together, but I'll take it. And so I think for anyone out there, probably my biggest learning is, and still to this day, the more that I can bring my whole self together, who I am in every facet of my life, when nobody's looking, when everybody's looking, when I'm on a podcast, when I'm in a board meeting, when I'm wherever I am, being the same person. And, you know, of course you could maybe, you know, censor yourself a little here or there, but I think that is maybe one of the biggest like life lessons, is to continue to hone that and continue to bring all those people more and more together.
You know, we spend too much of our time in our life at work to be different people. And that's not the people we
connect with. It's tiring. Yeah. If you like to go rage on the weekends and, you know, go to Ibiza and then you come in and you're like, hi, I'm Tim. Like, that's gotta be hard. You know, like, it sounds too hard to me.
I had a colleague once whose work voice was different than his regular voice.
Those are the best.
Like, I hear him on a call and he'd be like, this is Bob. Yes, how may I serve you? But like, he'd get off the call and sound totally different to me. And I could never figure out why he did that. And I don't think he knew he was doing it.
No, it's unconscious. Yeah, I've seen it a lot.
And he was the least producing person on the team, by the way, if that says anything. So, all right. So last question for you is, what's one thing we'd be surprised to learn about you?
I'm a huge Justin Bieber fan.
What?
I've been a Justin Bieber fan since the very beginning. I respect the kid, has talent. If you go on YouTube, you can play like 95 instruments. Like, this kid, I mean, he is very underrated as a musician. So I would say that that's it. And my wife may or may not have gotten me for my birthday. I'm 41 now. Like, I'm just going to call this out. We may or may not be going to the Justin Bieber concert in June this year. All right. So judge away.
I love it. What I love about the way you said that though, Jake, is you said it and then you gave me all the reasons. Like, you've clearly gotten pushback on this before.
Oh, lots of pushback. I've had to sell the skills of Biebs too much, you know, when his skills should speak for themselves.
Oh my God. That was fantastic. Thank you for that. That is surprising to learn about you. That's not, I don't know that I would have put those two things together, but I look forward to hearing how well and how fun the concert is.
All right. I'll let you know.
All right. Well, Jake, thank you so much. This has been, like I said, buckets of insight. So I appreciate
it. I love it. Well, thank you. I had a great time. And thank you everyone for listening.
Congratulations. By listening to this podcast, you took another step towards becoming an everyday innovator. To leap forward, visit www.gotolaunchstreet.com and take the Innovation Quotient Edge Assessment to discover your unique everyday innovator style and access the Everyday Innovator Digital Magazine for the top tools, insights, and inspiration at your fingertips 24/7. Tamara will be back with another Everyday Innovator Conversation soon. In the meantime, if you got a nugget of value out of this podcast, let Tamara know by leaving a 5-star review and comment. Your review equals more guests, more listens, bigger impact. Until next time.